Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're plunging into one of history's most persistent forces, really something that's shaped just about everything, every civilization, built grand monuments, but also led to, well, our deepest tragedies.
It's a force with two faces, isn't it? Building cathedrals, digging mass graves, liberating people, forging new chains.
Exactly. And that elemental force, of course, is power. And for this deep dive, we're kind of navigating this really complex terrain using insights from Mark Garlevin's forthcoming work on power.
Yeah, it promises to be quite revealing.
Our mission really is clear. We want to extract the crucial nuggets about what power truly is, you know, where it resides, who gets to wield it, and ultimately to what end.
And it's not just academic.
No, not at all. This isn't just a look back. It's meant as an urgent look at the present, maybe even a stark warning for the future. We want you to be able to sort of read the fine print of history.
Recognize those telltale signs of unchecked authority before it's too late.
Right. Because, as Levin really argues, before we could even think about constraining power, we absolutely have to understand its nature first.
And what's really insightful, I think, in Levin's approach is how he describes power. He doesn't frame it as inherently evil, but rather as inherently dangerous. He uses this analogy like it's a primal energy, almost like fire.
Okay, fire. How so?
Well, fire can give you warmth, light, you know, sustain life. But if it's uncontrolled, it can burn down everything you hold dear.
Right. So that reflects his core idea then, a deep skepticism of concentrated authority.
Exactly. That's a thread you see running through pretty much all his work. He's deeply wary of putting too much power in too few hands.
So if power is this primal energy, this potentially dangerous force, what does Levin see as the core impulse, the driver behind the lust for it? Is it just ambition?
He suggests it goes deeper than that. It stems from what he calls a dark aspect of human nature.
Okay.
This desire, basically, to compel, command, dominate others. It's fundamental, he argues. He calls it the philosophy of the tyrant.
The philosophy of the tyrant. That sounds ominous.
Well, it's this belief, right? That one person, maybe a small group, an elite, they possess the wisdom and therefore the right to plan and direct everyone else's lives.
It doesn't matter if they wear a crown
or a military uniform or even a modern tailored suit. The underlying impulse, Levin argues, is the same, subordinating the individual's will to the state's will.
And once that power is gathered, Levin seems very clear that it's almost never given up willingly.
That's a key point. It's like it takes on a life of its own. It wants to grow, expand its reach, consume any competing authorities, silence dissent. He puts it quite vividly, power is a jealous god.
A jealous god. And crucially, these threats, these encroachments on liberty, they don't always announce themselves loudly, do they?
Yeah.
Levin points out they often come disguised.
Precisely. Cloaked in this language of benevolence, they promise security, equality, justice. Sounds good, right?
Of course. Who wouldn't want that?
But the offer is basically give up some freedom, get some safety in return. And Levin just passionately argues this is a fool's bargain.
A fool's bargain, because the security you get is.
Well, he contends it ultimately becomes the security of a prison cell.
Mm.
And the equality. It's often the equality of serfs. Everyone equally subject to the rulers.
And the common good becomes
a euphemism, essentially, for whatever the ruling class wants. His work really serves as a kind of field guide for spotting these tactics.
Levin looks at history as this vast laboratory, doesn't he? Where political ideas get tested, sometimes with just awful results. He takes us through Rome, for instance. How does he show that republic decaying?
Yeah, he argues it wasn't some sudden collapse. It was a slow burn. Ambition, you know, giving the people bread and circuses to keep them quiet.
Distractions.
Right. And this creeping centralization of authority, all of it gradually undermining those Roman traditions of liberty. The path of the Caesars, he shows, was paved with things like emergency powers, so-called temporary measures.
That somehow become permanent.
Exactly. And critically, the people's own apathy, just letting it happen. It's a potent lesson in how easily things can slip away.
And from that slow decay, he shifts focus to the Dark Ages, to absolute monarchies and this idea of the divine right of kings. Totally different justification for power.
Completely different. This wasn't about consent of the governed at all. Divine right was the ultimate top-down claim. Power comes directly from God. End of story.
Which makes the king's authority
unquestionable, basically. It fused political and spiritual power, making obedience not just a legal duty, but a moral one. A stark example of how entrenched that kind of thinking can become.
Then we jump forward to the incredibly bloody 20th century modern totalitarianism. Levin really dissects what he calls the intellectual poison of Marx. He argues that utopian promise just became the grim reality of the gulag, the killing fields, the laogai in China. How does he draw that line from Marxism to those outcomes?
For Levin, Marxism isn't about liberation. He sees it fundamentally as a blueprint for total power.
A blueprint?
Yeah, because he asserts it demands the complete subjugation of the individual, their property, their thoughts, their very soul to the collective. And in practice, the collective always means the state and the party running the state.
So things like the Jacobin terror, the Bolshevik terror, Mao's purges, he sees those not as accidents, but
as logical, inevitable outcomes. He argues these ideologies fundamentally wage war on basic human nature, on private property, family, religion. So the terror follows naturally, in his view.
And importantly, he doesn't just focus on Marxism. He also tackles fascism, trying to get past how the word is often thrown around today. How does he define its core?
He strips it back to basics. It's another collectivist ideology. It worships the state. The individual is just a cog in the machine, existing only to serve the nation's destiny.
And the surprising link he makes between fascism and communism, despite being enemies.
Right. He highlights that despite fighting each other bitterly, they were, in his analysis, brothers in some crucial ways.
Brothers how?
Brothers in their hatred of individualism, their contempt for liberal democracy, and ultimately their worship of raw, untrammeled power. That's the common denominator he points to.
Okay, so that's a heavy tour through history. What does Levin argue all this means for us right now? How does he bring these lessons into the present, specifically regarding, say, the modern American progressive movement?
Well, he argues that while the context and methods are obviously different, this movement, in his view, shares a dangerous intellectual lineage with those older collectivist ideologies.
In what ways? What does he point to?
He points to things like the consistent push for a larger, more centralized government, the growth of what he calls the administrative state, we can get into that, attempts to control speech and thought, often framed as fighting disinformation or hate speech, and also what he sees as a drive to subordinate individual rights to group identity politics. For Levin, these aren't fundamentally new threats, just old poisons in new bottles.
Okay, you mentioned the administrative state. Levin focuses quite a bit on that. What exactly is he describing, and why is it such a problem from his perspective?
He describes it almost like a headless, unaccountable fourth branch of government. You know, this alphabet soup of agencies, the EPA, IRS, DOE, countless others.
Right.
The problem, he argues, is that they combine powers the founders deliberately separated. These agencies often have quasi-legislative power. They write detailed regulations like laws, quasi-executive power, they enforce them, and quasi-judicial power, they adjudicate disputes over them.
All under one roof, often with unelected officials.
Exactly. Unelected bureaucrats doing all three. For Levin, that's the very definition of the kind of consolidated power, the tyranny, that the Constitution's structure, particularly the separation of powers, was designed to prevent.
And his critique extends to the legal system, too, specifically this idea of a living constitution. What's his issue with that?
He argues that the living constitution theory is essentially designed to free judges from the actual text and original meaning of the document. Allowing them to effectively update or rewrite the constitution from the bench based on their own political preferences or perceived societal needs. So when judges do that, Levin contends, the constitution stops being a fixed charter that limits government.
It becomes
like a lump of clay, something malleable that can be shaped to authorize almost any expansion of government power that the ruling elite wants. It replaces the rule of law with the rule of men, essentially.
Then there are the cultural forces he discusses. He's quite critical of the mainstream media and academia. What role does he see them playing in this dynamic?
Well, he's quite blunt. He contends the mainstream media often functions less like an independent watchdog and more like a propaganda arm or even a Praetorian guard.
Praetorian guard. Yeah. Like the Roman emperor's bodyguards who sometimes pick the next emperor.
Exactly. Protecting the established order, sometimes shaping it. And academia, in his view, has largely become, as he puts it, a factory for leftist indoctrination, teaching students what to think, not how to think, and often instilling contempt for American history and principles like individual liberty.
He then takes aim at specific ideologies he labels as forms of cultural Marxism, things like wokeism, critical race theory, intersectionality. How does he characterize these?
He argues these ideologies fundamentally divide people into warring identity groups, race, gender, etc. They replace the focus on individual rights and equality under the law with, in his words, a mix of group grievance, collective guilt, and a demand for equity.
Equity meaning equal outcomes, not equal opportunity.
Right, equal outcomes enforced by the state. He contends this whole approach is just a recipe for endless social conflict and, crucially, a justification for massive government expansion into every part of life.
Paints a pretty bleak picture. He seems to be echoing Tocqueville's warning about a soft tyranny.
Very much so. That idea of a government that doesn't necessarily break your will, but softens, bends, and directs it until the people become like a flock of timid and industrious animals, with the government as the shepherd. It's a chilling image he invokes.
It really is. But as you said, Levin doesn't just diagnose the problem. On Power, particularly the second half, seems focused on the cure. And for him, that cure lies in the foundations laid back in 1787.
Absolutely. He champions the U.S. Constitution as, well, maybe the single greatest achievement in the history of human governance. Why? Because its primary design wasn't to empower rulers.
It was to restrain them.
Precisely. He emphasizes the founders weren't naive utopians. They were hardened realists. They knew, as Madison famously wrote in Federalist 51, that men were not angels.
Right.
So the huge challenge was crafting a government strong enough to control the people, but then crucially structured so it would be obliged to control itself.
So how did they try to achieve that? Yeah. What are the key pillars of this design for limiting power, according to Levin?
He really walks us through the brilliance of it. First, the separation of powers. They didn't put all authority in one place. They deliberately split it. Legislative, executive, judicial, three co-equal branches.
Each with its own job, and crucially,
each empowered to push back against the others. Ambition must be made to counteract ambition, as Madison put it. This friction, this tension between the branches, that wasn't a bug, it was the system, designed specifically to slow power down, prevent it from getting concentrated.
Okay, so separation of powers is one. Then there's federalism. That's about dividing power differently, right?
Exactly. It's not just separating powers within the federal government. It's also dividing power between the federal government and the states. A compound republic, they called it.
And the idea was the federal government only had specific listed powers.
Few and defined enumerated powers. Levin stresses that the vast majority of governing authority was meant to be reserved to the states or directly to the people. This creates multiple centers of power, acting as another crucial bulwark for liberty. It allows states to be, you know, laboratories of democracy.
Trying different approaches.
Right. Avoiding a one-size-fits-all national control.
And the third pillar, the Bill of Rights. Levin gets really passionate about these, but maybe not in the way people usually think about them.
Yeah, he argues very strongly they are not gifts from the government. They're not permissions. They are explicit prohibitions on the government.
Stop signs for the state.
Exactly. They declare certain fundamental areas of life basically off limits to state power. Your conscience, your speech, self-defense, property, privacy. These aren't rights the government grants. They are rights that pre-exist government, endowed by our creator, as the Declaration says.
So the government's job isn't to grant them, but to...
to secure them, to protect these pre-existing unalienable rights. That flips the whole relationship on its head compared to most systems throughout history.
You can really see the influence of thinkers like Locke on natural rights, Montesquieu on separation of powers, Cicero on the rule of law.
Absolutely. And later thinkers, too, like Tocqueville observing American civil society, or Bastiat showing how law can be twisted from protecting liberty to enabling plunder. Levin presents the Constitution as drawing on this deep well of wisdom about human nature and power.
Okay, so if that's the cure, the diagnosis, and the prescription, how do we administer it? This is where Levin shifts from analysis to action, right? The Great Restoration.
Indeed. The book doesn't end on a note of despair. It's really a clarion call to action, a summons for citizens to, well, wake up and reclaim what he sees as their birthright.
And the ultimate check isn't just the document itself.
No. He argues the ultimate check isn't just parchment. It has to be a virtuous and vigilant citizenry, a people who actually know their rights and, as he puts it, knowing dare to maintain them.
So what does that look like in practice? What are the key actions he calls for in this Great Restoration?
He outlines a few key things. First, become students of our own history and founding principles. Actually read the Constitution, the Declaration, the Federalist Papers.
You can't defend what you don't understand.
Precisely his point. That's step one. Foundational knowledge.
Okay, what's next?
Second, engage actively in civic life. And he means more than just casting a vote every couple of years. It means really paying attention, showing up school board meetings, city council meetings, speaking out respectfully but firmly against government overreach. And, he adds, supporting candidates he terms true constitutional conservatives.
So education and engagement, what's the third piece?
The third involves using the tools the founders themselves provided, plus a deeper element. He revisits the idea of a convention of states under Article V of the Constitution.
As a way for the states to bypass Congress.
Exactly. As a peaceful constitutional tool for the people, acting through their states, to propose amendments that could impose things like fiscal restraints, term limits, or other structural reforms on the federal government. But even more fundamentally, he calls for a moral and spiritual renewal.
Connecting liberty to.
To a belief in a transcendent moral order, in rights coming from a creator, not from government. He warns that a society that loses its moral compass similarly won't remain free for long.
It's fascinating how he frames this whole thing as this ongoing, really profound choice we constantly face. Liberty versus security.
Individualism versus collectivism.
A government of laws versus a government of men.
Yeah, and his reminder that freedom isn't the default setting for humanity. It's rare, it's fragile, it can genuinely be lost in a single generation.
So the struggle against power's corrupting influence isn't something that was won in 1787.
Not at all. It's an eternal struggle, a battle that, as Levin really underscores, must be fought anew by every generation. It falls to us now.
So, as we wrap up this deep dive, the core message seems clear. Power is inherently dangerous, it always seeks to expand, and our vigilance is really the only lasting defense.
That sums it up well.
And maybe a final thought for you, the listener, to mull over. As you go about your day, think about what personal liberties, maybe small ones, you might be unknowingly trading away for some perceived security or convenience in your own life, in your community.
What small steps, what little encroachments, if you let them slide, could eventually pave the way for that soft tyranny Tocqueville and Levin warn about?
Because understanding these powerful forces, as Levin argues so forcefully, that's the essential first step if we want to hold that torch of liberty high for the next generation.